The following program may contain difficult or triggering subject matter. Listener discretion is advised. CJAM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CJAM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's HandyLink. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, Zoe Gross will be telling us about autistic advocacy. So what can you tell me about autistic advocacy?
Sure, so the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network is a policy advocacy organization run by and for autistic adults. We're based in Washington, D.C. We've been around since 2006, when we were run by a small group of autistic volunteers, and now we have about 20 staff and offices in D.C. We have different kinds of policy goals that we work towards. We're advocating for laws and rules that would benefit people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. One example for that would be advocating for more funding for Medicaid home and community-based services, or ending restraint and seclusion in public schools would be another one. We advocate for more funding for research that would help autistic people, and we create educational materials in accessible formats to help people with intellectual and developmental disabilities learn about policy issues that affect our lives.
So, how do you reach out to the public to let them know that you are pushing for meaningful change for these individuals?
So, we create a lot of materials. We have toolkits that we share on our webpage and through social media, and also we have some books that we created as well, focusing on, there's one that serves kind of as an introduction to autism for people that may be newly diagnosed or just new to the community or want to learn more about autism. And then there's one focused on parents of newly diagnosed children. We have a couple others, but mainly we use social media to reach people, as well as other organizations will use the work that we put out. Like self-advocacy groups may use it in discussions, for example.
So, in your advocacy, what methods do you use to speak to any myths or misperceptions about autism?
So, like I said, we have several books available, and we also have an About Autism page on our website, which is one of the pages that people most visit on our site. We try to explain what autism is from an autistic perspective. Really kind of give an inside-out view of autism, not just what are the diagnostic criteria, but what is the experience of being autistic like. And we talk about that in our About Autism page as well as our books. And one of the things we address is myths about autism. So like the idea that autistic people don't care about other people is one myth about autism that we debunk and talk about how that isn't true. There's myths about what causes autism that we address as well, so you can read our book, Welcome to the Autistic Community, for more information on those.
So, do you find the communities typically receptive to the ideas of change that you're presenting?
I think it really takes a long time for, what's out in the culture to change in terms of changing ideas about autism. But I have seen change since I started working in autistic advocacy. You know, when I came into autistic advocacy, the mainstream kind of line was, we want a cure for autism. And that's what the large organizations were saying, and that's what many people working in the field of autism were saying. And then self-advocates were saying something different, saying we don't want a cure is not possible, what we need is to improve the lives of autistic people who are alive today. And no one is using the word cure anymore, or very few people are using the word cure anymore. Large organizations are not, many people working in the field are not, because we've moved away from that idea and towards the idea of what will give people a good life. And we may disagree on what that is, but we've as more research has come out, the idea of cure has been kind of more and more discredited. People are using it less and less. So that's one example of how ideas about autism can change over time.
So in your time with autistic advocacy, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you?
Yeah, there's a couple. One is in 2017, when Congress was trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. You know, this was something that they, in theory, had enough people supporting repeal that they could have done it. But there was so much outcry against it and advocacy from the disability community, and ASAN was a part of that, but there were many other organizations as well, that eventually it wasn't something they were able to completely repeal, so we still have the protections from the Affordable Care Act. For example, being able to get insurance coverage for pre-existing conditions and things like that, because they weren't able to pass repeal. Another more complicated one is more recent one is the trying to ban the electric shock devices that are used at the Judd Rotenberg Center. Have you heard about this?
I have not.
Okay, so there's an institution in Massachusetts called the Judd Rotenberg Center, which is it's a place where people are sent, often by other states, who have more intense support needs, and maybe other placements haven't worked out for them. And at the Judge Rotenberg Center, some of the people that live there, they forced to wear a device that can give them electric shocks. And the shocks are very painful, and people who've been on this device describe, you know, it can burn you, and also it's so much trauma that's caused by being forced to wear this device. People have PTSD, depression, anxiety as a result of being forced to wear it, and being shocked by the staff there. So we're trying to get the FDA to ban the use of the device. And after decades of advocacy, in 2020 they did ban it, and then the next year the DC Circuit Court overturned the ban. So that was a victory that kind of was taken away. And then the FDA is working on a new rule, so they're going to ban it again. But recently in Congress, some people introduced a part of a bill that would have taken away the FDA's power to make a new ban, so they couldn't do it. With advocacy from the disability community, lots of grassroots advocacy, people getting together to call their representatives and advocate against this bill, it was that part of the bill was taken out. So the FDA still has the power to pass the new rule for the ban. So getting that bill rider taken out was a recent success that I'm really proud of.
So with that being an ongoing battle, what would the ideal outcome be if you could see anything added for support of autism that wouldn't be something hurtful or demeaning in any way to the autistic community? What would you like to see added?
It's really hard to pick just one because there's so many places where we need policy to change for autistic people. But I think the place where I would start is home and community-based services. A lot of autistic people don't have the services that we need to live in our communities, and are forced either to go into an institution where we can't have our rights respected and live the way we want, or people are being given services kind of informally by family members and friends who don't get paid. And that's really a kind of precarious living situation to be in. It's not as stable, it's not as guaranteed. And then, of course, the unpaid support, people may not always be able to provide it. So there's many people going without supports that they really need to do daily activities like dressing, bathing, food prep, meals, transportation, all those kinds of things. And they need more support for that. Expanding home and community-based services would make it so more people can access that support, because currently in many states there's a waiting list that can be up to 10 years long, and we would want to get rid of that so there's no wait, and then expand the criteria so more people are are able to get these services that are really life-changing, life-saving services.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Totally.
In this segment of our show, Eric Bailey will be talking about his work in digital accessibility. So what can you tell me about your work in digital accessibility?
Yeah, I am an accessibility designer at GitHub, where I help to fix existing access issues as well as work on new features and functionality to make sure that they are accessible out of the gate. Been here for about a year and a half, and it's been really good so far, really rewarding.
So, are there any common trends among the needs and shortcomings of what's accessible?
That's a really good question. The thing that I always kind of keep in the back of my mind is survivor bias, which is a little bit of a cliche in my field, but is also very real, which is you want to make sure you're thinking about who isn't there structurally because they are not enabled to be present. And we've actually seen some of that in feature work or remediation work where people that now can mechanically actually operate the UI are starting to be more vocal about it, which is great because it means that they have the ability to use something where they didn't before. In terms of larger trends, I think one thing that is always kind of partner just got home. Can do a little pause for editing. Actually, one moment. The thing that is always top of mind is performance. And, you know, that's another case, I think, of survivorship bias, where is the experience usable on, like, a lower-powered device? A lot of the time, we tend to forget that just because we're building these experiences with, like, top-of-the-line laptops, that's not always reflective of the people that consume our service. And there's a little bit of like, you know, it may not be a low-end smartphone. It could be like a provisioned laptop, you know, from 5 years ago that's just like chugging along, that's like in a corporate environment.
So what would you say is the most innovative step you've taken towards creating accessibility?
A lot of the work I do is, in terms of innovation, it's glue work. So it's not necessarily creating new assistive technology or changing code. It's demystifying and normalizing accessibility to engineers and designers and like connecting them to the resources that they need, providing guidance for how to approach some of these things. And we've really seen a network effect happen where, like, the more you do it, the more it's expected to be done. So the more that, like, it just becomes part of the regular course of doing business. And that's really good, not only for, you know, ultimately the people that use our service, but also for just helping us do what we do. Each interaction isn't like some uphill battle where we need to justify our existence and prove the business value. It's just another box to check, like you would with security and like code quality.
So in that sense, do you find that it's easier to build something with accessibility in mind than to go back and reinvent the wheel?
Oh yeah, we have numbers to prove it. One of the things that we're doing at GitHub is self-auditing our existing content. And GitHub is a very old, very large website. And the thing that we're seeing is the delta between the cost of identifying and fixing issues versus putting out something that is mostly accessible by default is quantifiable and pretty excitingly so. So like, if appeals to empathy don't work for, you know, leadership at your organization, you can definitely point to this sort of information and be like, do you enjoy saving money in the long run? Well, guess what? A little upfront work goes a long way.
So, do you ever find there's a sense of surprise about what can be made accessible? I mean, I'd imagine that creating accessible user interfaces, that not everyone's entirely versed on what's possible.
Yeah. There are a few experiences that we're working on, including reviewing pull requests, that are very, like, dynamic, very complicated. And the thing that I like to say internally is, you know, we can do it. It's just a matter of time and resources. And we're finding that we can make these experiences accessible and usable. We can also think really deeply about what is accessible and usable really mean. Is a web UI the best way to do this? Is this something that is better done in the command line? I know a lot of blind engineers use the command line for Git and GitHub because of the ergonomics it provides. So, like, taking a really holistic look at these experiences and, like, A, making them technically compliant and operable, but also B, thinking about how to best serve the people that use these services.
So, in your time creating accessibility in this way, is there any success story that stands out for you?
Yeah. This is a recent one, and it's powerful. And, like, I want to be very clear here. Like, I don't want to have this come off as, like, saviorism, nor do I want to, like, tokenize the experience, but the thing I'm currently working on is community feedback issues, and there was an issue where somebody was asking for heading elements to be added to a core part of the experience, and I was able to update our templates to include headings, and it sounds like a very simple thing, but you know, simple often isn't, and but the end effect is it allowed them to use this service, period, whereas before they were having somebody else kind of intervene on their behalf. And so, like, the autonomy that grants, the quality of life that that enables, the opportunities that that opens up, all are really important to me, and I feel fortunate that I was kind of in the right place at the right time to have that happen. I feel dismayed that it was not built correctly to start, but, you know, every little bit you can kind of push helps, and it's really nice to see, like, a direct and immediate impact for these kinds of things.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Windsor Amputee Support Group aims to provide a place where amputees can share their experiences. The WASG arranges guest speakers, social gatherings, and a peer support mentor program, which is available to both amputees and their families. Our office is now at Hotel de Grasse Healthcare on Prince Road. Appointments are required. To contact the Windsor Amputee Support Group, call 226-347-6678 or email windsoramps@gmail.com. For more information, visit windsoramps.ca.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Zoe Gross told us a little bit about autistic advocacy, and Eric Bailey took us through creating digital accessibility through GitHub. Now, this next interview, folks, is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Catherine Campion will be telling us about PACT. So what can you tell me about PACT?
Well, we started in 2008, and we started as a community theater for the general public, and we wanted to teach skills like self-esteem, cooperation, things like that through theater. And we had an article about us in a local paper, and after that, parents with kids with autism started coming to our programs, registering their children, and some of them were professionals in the performing arts area. You know, all of them were incredible people. So they joined our board and our teaching staff and created our curriculum, so it was well suited for people with autism. And it just has kind of grown organically since then.
So what are some of the benefits for someone with autism being a part of performing arts?
Performing arts in general, well, it's definitely camaraderie building, which is something that a lot of people with autism are isolated, and just coming together with other peers and creating something together. We do a lot of improv and, you know, just being able to think in the moment, and it's all fun. It's all, we're not talking about autism at the classes. People are just enjoying the performing arts, and it's healing, and it's good for confidence. There have been some friendships that have been developed over the years that for pretty sure all of them is their main social group or only social group. And this means a lot to them. I know that. Something that we have done since 2016 is we started hiring people with autism to teach people with autism the performing arts and training them. And that has been really wonderful for these guys. They often express their gratitude for, if you want to empower somebody, give them a job and train them and help them find a place for themselves in the world.
So, do you use any modified teaching techniques for those with autism who want to come in and perform?
Modified? You mean modified for people with autism?
Yes.
So, like I said, our curriculum, very early on, 2009, was developed by the mother of two kids with autism. She was a BA in theater arts and a master's in psychology, and she created, there are basic improv activities that we do in the programs, but with that headset that she had, she created it in a way that would be maybe easier for somebody with autism to participate in. One of the things that is underlying all our programs is respect for everyone, and that goes a long way with everybody.
So, in your time with PACT, has there been any success moment or story concerning one of your participants with autism that stands out for you?
Well, I would say somebody that came to our program in 2009 as a young teenager, and he has developed into one of our lead teachers, and he's gone from, not feeling a lot of confidence to, he's got this booming voice that fills the room, and, he really does care about the people in our class because he knows what it's like. Nobody knows what it's like more than somebody with autism to live with autism every day. So there's just sort of an understanding. And he has grown so much, and he's one of the people whose social group has been born out of our programs. And, his life is still a challenge. His life is challenging if you have autism, but he is doing really well. And another of our other lead teacher has been with us since 2015, and he has similarly gone from not being able to finish a sentence in some cases to being an incredible teacher. I mean, they almost are on celebrity status with the people in the class, you know, just because they're talented people and they're compassionate people, and it's just has worked.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for inclusion in the arts, what would you say?
Give them a job.
Simple as that?
Simple as that. And train them.
So, are there any projects on the horizon for PACT?
Well, we're just about to perform our musical, which is the first musical we've ever done. And then in the fall, we're starting something called Improv to a Job. And it is going to help people with autism find and keep jobs, develop careers, create micro-businesses. And we're excited about it. We're in the middle of developing the program, and it's going to start September 22nd. It'll be an in-person program, but we have found that theater works really well online. Not everything does, but we found that out during the pandemic, so we'll probably have an online aspect to that too, because not everybody can get to our programs.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks. I want to speak to one of the key points Zoe made during her interview about the shock devices. I am honestly astounded that this is legal, or even was legal. It can be detrimental enough isolating someone from society, then asking that they follow society's expectations with no real concept, no real first-hand experience, what that might look like. But adding physical pain, adding something that is going to hurt them and leave a lasting psychological scar, my opinion, that is simply unacceptable. For the fact of the matter is, these are people with potentials, dreams and hopes all their own. Maybe their condition leaves them in a state they can't express them in exactly the same way others can, but that does not give us the right to cause them any injury or do anything that would add to what they're already facing. Yes, it's true that in some cases more in-depth treatment is required for some of the more extreme versions of a given disability. The fact is, I maintain it's time and care and patience that will achieve the best results. You can't just lock someone away and forget about them simply because it can be a difficult thing to deal with. These are people with friends, families, loved ones. And to be quite honest, the history of institutionalization has shown that in many cases, the person might come out better for one set of conditions, but they might come out worse for another. When she described PTSD in these patients, that is adding something that doesn't need to be there. Adding an injury to a disability, something they have no control over, that is not something we can ethically justify. We can choose to inflict pain or not on these people. And I must say, I am pleased that progress is being made. But the fact that it was even allowed in recent memory, in any way, I find it utterly baffling. For we as a society must keep taking steps forward to ensure not only the respect, but the protection and the dignity of all persons with or without disabilities. We're all part of this tapestry, my friends. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.